My mother's German, and she has this old school thinking of, you know, whatever she managed to get or someone gave her, she held on to it. And I'm a bit old fashioned in that way, that I get attached to my things that I own. Mm-hmm. Is it the smartest thing? No. You know, does it make the most sense? Probably not. When you buy something and you start using it, you build a relationship with it. Mm-hmm. Today, people get bored of things very quickly. They sell it, they move on. You know, if you're always getting rid of things, you can't build up a history with it.
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverant, and this is Hodinkee Radio. We've got a pretty wide gamut of stuff on the show this week. We're going to start off with Cole and James talking about some of the new watches that have come since Watches and Wonders last week. We're going to talk a little bit about Watches and Wonders, we can't avoid it, and I want those guys' perspective, but we're really going to focus on a collection of cool, affordably priced tool watches that dropped this week, kind of in the aftermath of the show. We've got stuff from Doxa, from Zin, from G-Shock, and a really special piece that doesn't fit that mold, but that we kind of have to talk about anyway. We're also going to discuss Cole's recent spat of stories about retailers and what it's like for us who don't typically deal with that side of the industry to all of a sudden get to talk to these guys a lot and really get some insight into what they do. There's also a preview of a story that's going to run later this week, but I'll let Cole tell you about that. After that, we've got a conversation that was recorded before all of this craziness started between Ben and collector Edmund Sarin. He splits his time between Zurich and New York, and you might know him from his website and his Instagram account, Le Monde Edmond. He and Ben talk about the rise of vintage Rolex, including some of the more unusual pieces, how Edmund got into vintage watch collecting in the first place, and the push and pull between being an enthusiast yourself and trying to provide some outside perspective for others. You should give him a follow on Instagram, by the way, if you don't already, at Le Monde Edmond, with some underscores between the words. It's great. If you like things like Stellina Rolexes, old Bond stills, you're going to absolutely love it. It's a great follow. Like I said, there's something in this week's episode for everybody. We've got affordable, we've got super high-end, we've got vintage, we've got modern. If you like watches, you're going to like this week's show. So with that in mind, let's do it. Hey guys, good to talk to you.
Hey Stevie.
Good morning, Stevie.
This is what, like week eight, I think, of work from home? Something like that?
No idea.
Yeah, I lost track a long time ago.
Time's a flat circle at this point. Every week is just a week, you know? I really am not going to lie. I could really use a day date right now. Buying all of these like three-hand no-date watches has proved to be quite the folly on my part, considering now I have no idea when or where I am in the universe.
Yeah, I went with a no date watch the last couple of days, and it's been existentially problematic.
I've always aspired to live like this, so I'm fine.
People can't see, but your beard would attest to that, right?
Yep, exactly. That's right.
Man, I am missing my barber so much. Shout out to Mark, who I know listens to the show sometimes. Dude, cannot wait for our next hang. It's very, very overdue. You're going to have your work cut out for you. All right. So last week on the show, I had Ben and Jack on to talk about everything Watches and Wonders. That was kind of like our big story for the week. I know overwhelmed the three of us to just crank out as many stories and to see as many new watches as we saw. But, you know, some new stuff came out this week too, not from Watches and Wonders, and that's really what I wanted to have you guys on to talk about. It's watches that when I see them, I immediately think of the two of you. But before we do that, let's do a little Watches and Wonders recap quickly, since you guys weren't on the show last week. So, you know, the first thing I want to ask is what were your top picks from the show? Like maybe, you know, two or three watches that really stood out to each of you guys. Maybe James, you want to kick us off?
Yeah, sure. I mean, as far as like stuff that stood out for me, it's a kind of a small change to their lineup, but I think that it makes the watch what it should have been, and that's that the Vacheron Constantin Overseas Perpetual Calendar Ultra Thin with the blue dial. Now you can get it with the matching pink gold bracelet, and I think it's something that probably should just come out last year when they announced the bracelet. But my guess is there are people who were genuinely just waiting, like maybe not a lot of people, but like a handful of people who are like, well, they've got the blue and they've got, you know, the opaline dial now has the bracelet. And I'm sure they went to the boutique and asked, you know, can I buy just the bracelet, which I'm sure you can't. So now you can get it with the blue dial and you get the bracelet and the two blue straps. And I think for a pink gold watch, that's it's a pretty good looking QP.
Yeah, I totally agree. That watch is so killer. And I want to know how many people bought last year both the opaline dial and the blue dial so that they could swap the bracelet between the two of them.
Just
I guarantee
the bracelet
you
on for themselves,
a couple
yeah.
people did.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, I don't blame those people at all, to be honest. It's kind of absurd, but I don't blame those folks at all.
Yeah. I guess if you have the means, right? We saw people do similar stuff with the Oyster Flex straps from Rolex, you know, when they were still only available precious metal Daytonas and that sort of thing. So I think you've got to kind of buy all of it and mix and match on your own, which is insane. But I guess that's watch collecting, right? And beyond that lovely QP, I think that the Hermes Slim, the Hermes GMT in rose gold, that's exactly how that watch should look. It's so killer. I love the gold hands on that blue dial. Look really good. I think those are,
you're on a little rose and blue kick here.
Yeah, I think I am. I mean, and the only one that kind of kicks outside that is I think that new Jaeger Master Control calendar is also a pretty gorgeous thing.
Yeah, I totally agree. Cole, where's your head at here?
I think my top three were the Odysseus in white gold. I love it. Absolutely. The JLC Master Control date. So I actually like the simplicity of that one. And then on the kind of crazy end or whatever, the Laurent Ferrier Tourbillon Grand Sport. I think that has like by far the most beautiful movement out of the bunch. Maybe Odysseus as well, but really the Laurent Ferrier. Those are my top three.
The movement in those watches is absolutely bonkers. I mean, I saw their Grand Sport it's in the metal last year when they offered it on rubber as a limited edition. It's insane. I mean, like nobody is doing a tourbillon movement, especially a hidden tourbillon movement at that level, until maybe you get into like, you know, Grugel Forzi, but it's a totally different style. But in terms of like sort of traditional watchmaking, maybe with a little bit of a modern twist, you've got that like brushed ruthenium, finish to it that makes it a little darker, feel a little more contemporary. Those movements are just nuts. I mean, I remember the first time I ever saw a Laurent Ferrier movement. We had, back when they were, I mean, they're still hard to find and hard to get, but this was when they were like unobtainium. We had our friends at Manfredi had one, and their client very kindly, it was already pre-bought, and their client very kindly said that they could send it to us for a day before the client picked it up. They literally overnighted the watch to us. Ben and I received it. It was back when it was the two of us and Will. I think Will was out of town somewhere or something, but the two of us received the watch, unpacked it, shot it, packed it back up. And like 2 hours later, it was back at FedEx because the client was coming at noon the next day to pick it up. And it was the first time I'd ever seen one in the metal. And I remember just like my jaw was just on the floor the entire time. And, I guess like 8 years later, I am no less shocked by those watches every time I see them.
Yeah, they're gorgeous. Absolutely.
The other one that stands out for me just as a brand is like Cartier came correct. A lot of stuff from them. All of it really, really good. The new Dumont XL is killer. The Dumont LEs. Of the three, Steven, what's the gold one called? The number 14?
It's like the number 16B or something like that. BBIS.
Yeah. So cool.
The gold on gold one's killer.
And the Melian.
I really, really dig. Yeah.
Really cool stuff. Yeah, really cool stuff.
It's astounding to me that like Cartier continues to just crush it year after year. Like you would think they would run out of stuff because they don't launch one watch. You know, they launch like a whole collection, major updates to every other collection, some Privé stuff, some high jewelry, clocks. Like they go hard every year. And yet somehow there's always more to do. And it doesn't feel like repeats and, you know. Again, I've been covering Cartier now for like a decade, basically, and they haven't really had an off year. I mean, or a year where they don't at least have some home runs. Yeah, I mean, you guys also both have been covering this long enough. Like, you remember when Cartier was focusing really heavily on the, like, the high watchmaking stuff, the crazy complications, the minute repeaters, the perpetual calendars, the tourbillons, the mystery watches. And it's been really interesting, I think, for me to see over the last couple of years them kind of pivot back toward what's, like, core Cartier, which is design, right? It's not about some new crazy skeletonized minute repeater movement that they developed. It's about the Tank Asymmetrique. It's about the Santos Dumont. It's about new things like the Mayon. You know, it's creating, like, you know, for lack of a better word, like icons, like things that you can recognize from across a room and go, holy shit, that's special.
Yeah, agreed. They come from jewelry, right? So kind of makes
yeah,
sense.
Yeah, and, you know, I've said before, like, I own a Santos Dumont in the smallest size. It's quartz. It's steel. Like, it's a pretty, you know, unassuming watch in a lot of ways. I've owned it for about a year now. I have never once looked at it and gone, ugh, I wish this was mechanical. Like, that is literally never. I mean, I guess in theory, sure, like, all things being equal, why not? But in wearing it, I have never once felt that it was impoverished by that. Because Cartier just does such a good job on the other stuff that you're like, ah, whatever. You know, it's fine. Mm. Cool. We could probably do another whole show on this, and I'm sure we'll go over it more, but we got some other releases this week that I want to make sure we get into. So the reason I picked the two of you guys to hop on a call with this week is we got some watches this week that are in the more affordable end of the spectrum. They're from classic kind of like cult watch aficionado tool watch brands, and they're pieces that all have something like sort of new and interesting about them. So we've got stuff from Doxa, from Zin, from G-Shock. And then I've got kind of one outlier I want to take your pulse on. But let's start with Doxa. You know, woke up one morning this week to this press release in my inbox, and I was like, wait, what? James, can you maybe tell us about this watch?
Yeah, so basically the fast route for people who wouldn't know any of the following small references is Doxa is obviously a dive watch brand that was kind of born in the mid-60s, highly connected with Cousteau and a bunch of Cousteau's businesses as well. And at one point, U.S. Divers, which was the distribution company that Cousteau made, to sell the Aqualung, which was his early kind of evolution of the scuba system. He also used that company to become the sole distributor of Doxa's first kind of tool dive watch, the Sub 300 of 1967. If we fast forward to 2017, they did a 50th anniversary of this model, which was a literal laser scan of the old one. It's an almost one-to-one recreation, as faithful as you could be without going into any like faux tina or kind of fake patina or whatever you'd like to call that. Those were very popular. They made 300 in each of the brand's kind of iconic colors. A black dial is called a Shark Hunter, an orange is a professional, and a silver dial is called a Sea Rambler. Those all sold out. Then they started making a few special editions, which have what are called Black Lung or Aqua Lung dials. That depends on the outline of the logo, but it carries that U.S. Divers Aqua Lung logo on the dial, which connects back to these ones that were made specifically for U.S. distribution via Cousteau. What I'm trying to say here is this is a brand with a very interesting, often ignored history, and they make one of the most kind of funky, unique, fun-loving tool dive watches in existence. And for this brand new model, they took the Sub 300 formula and they rendered the case and the bezel in forged carbon. So it's a limited edition piece called the Doxa Sub 300 Carbon Aqualung US Divers LE. And they basically took the exact same formula from the 2017 models, but changed up how it's made. They also went with a yellow black and yellow motif, which is the brand has never done a yellow minute hand on a watch like this in the past. So you're looking at, it's a forged carbon outer case. If you're really into carbon fiber and forged carbon's use in watches or cars, you'll know that it comes in many, many different manners. In this scenario, you have a titanium inner case. That's where the movement would mount, where the crown screws in, where the case back screws in, and the rest is kind of a forged carbon shroud wrapped around that. So it's super light. It's 87 grams, 42.5 millimeters, a little less than 13.5 millimeters thick. 300 meter water resistance. And I think it's absolutely gorgeous. You know, I'm a huge fan of the sub 300 re-editions from 2017. And the difference here is, you know, those watches came out at, say, $2,500. And this Doxa is also a limited edition of 300 pieces, but at almost $4,800, $4,790.
Yeah, I think even though it's like basically double the price of a steel Doxa, I still look at this watch and I'm like, that feels like pretty good value to me. I mean, like this watch reminds me a lot in a funny way of the offshore diver that AP did sure. a couple years ago, which I think was also yellow in forged carbon.
Correct,
I know there was a
yes.
yellow one and an orange one. Yeah, the yellow one was the forged carbon. The orange, I think, was the ceramic one. But like this watch has a lot of that kind of like tool watch. It's slightly elevated by the carbon. It's got this stealthy mm-hmm. vibe to it. It's cool. Like I'm not, you know, I get Doxa as a thing. Like I understand it. It doesn't generally speak to me personally. This is a watch I want to see. Like I'm kind of excited by this. It feels like an interesting direction to take the brand in. I mean, Cole, you're a Doxa fan. Like what do you think about this? Like it seems like a bit of a departure. Do you feel like it's too far? Do you think it's right in the wheelhouse? What's your take on this? You have a much better sense than I do.
So I don't know. I won't say I'm a purist. I think I am patiently waiting to see it in the metal to see what I think, but like one of the lines, again, this is pre-Hodinkee. One of the lines that stood out to me from one of Jason's pieces was like something like the case was rendered in 316L just like God had intended. Something like that. Mm-hmm. And for me, I think of historic Doxas and so forth. And I've seen Squale. Squale did a bunch of watches in carbon and so forth. And then when that happened, I was like, oh, man, another one of these like iconic dive brands is maybe losing the plot. I doubt that's the case with Doxa because they just don't do anything wrong for the most part. But mm-hmm. as a sort of purist in this kind of watchmaking, I like steel. So let's see what happens. But
all right.
Yeah, I just got to see it in the metal, you know, or see it in the carbon rather.
So I got to ask for you guys. Carbon or solid gold? Which crazy Doxa are we going for? What's the move here, James?
Well, like for a 300, because the solid gold is the chronograph, which is a whole different thing on wrist. For a 300, it'd be gold for sure. I think carbon's fine. I don't know. My thing with forged carbon is because it's not unlike carbon fiber, where we say carbon fiber, but Cole, you would know this from the automotive space. You can buy actual carbon fiber stuff for a few dollars on eBay, or you can see some sort of a piece of something that was made by hand by Koenigsegg that could cost $40,000 and weighs less than a golf ball. The range at which this material exists is like saying it's metal. Okay, well, is it aluminum? Is it steel? Right. Is it tin? Is it pig iron? Is it aerodyne? Like what are we talking about here? What is the makeup? Right. So the big thing is you know, if you read a lot about carbon and forged carbon cases, is edge retention can be an issue because of the way that they're mm-hmm. made. And you know, in this scenario, they're essentially milling out a block of carbon material, and it's not necessarily something that's meant to take a lot of wear. I can't say that's the scenario with the Doxa, but I, you know, forged carbon cases have been around even at much lesser price points for a long time. Ocean 7 had a watch under $1,000, which used a steel core, but had a forged carbon case. And if I remember correctly, I would have to ask Mitch for clarification, because this would have been a decade ago, but they went with a more curved case shape because they weren't known to keep really crisp lines. On forged carbon. So the thing that comes down to is who's making the product, where does it come from, you know, what are its actual properties? I think forged carbon looks incredible, but as a watch case, is it going to be better than steel? No, I don't think so. And the other thing to consider is like Cole said, is it's one thing if this is a flagship product that they get to keep on their website for a while. They didn't make that many. Visually, it's gorgeous. I think it's super cool. It's another thing if this is indicating where the brand wants to take the 300. You know, it's that thing where you kind of want I want Doxus to stay at you know, sub $2,000 steel, ready to buy and then wear for, you know, all sorts of purposes, including diving and otherwise. And I think as a collectory sort of item, this new carbon thing is amazing. I think it's super cool.
Yeah, good.
Cool.
Good
well, I don't want to rush you guys along too much, but since we got a couple other watches to talk to, I think this is actually a nice segue, right? The idea that this is a tool watch and it's now being rendered in a way that maybe makes it not such a tool watch. It makes it maybe more of a collector's piece. On the other side of that, we've got the Zin that was released this week, the U50. Cole, maybe you can kick us off on this because I know you are a big Zin fan.
Yeah, it's Zin. I always pronounce it Sin, and I feel like I should probably pronounce it the German way, but I'm just going to say Sin. So if anyone comments and say you're pronouncing it wrong, I apologize.
Maybe I'll pronounce it both ways so that people can give me shit in the comments.
But yeah, I've loved Sin. That's like one of the first watch brands that I've liked ever. And I think the coolest thing about this release is this is the watch we've literally been waiting for forever. Like, imagine being younger and having a smaller wrist or whatever, getting into Sin, loving the philosophy and everything. And then you put it on, you're like, well, I can't do this. You know, I can't wear this thing. It's huge. So this is one of their coolest watches rendered in a
size. What is the watch?
It's a U50. Oh, the Sin U50. But people will know the design from the Sin U1.
Right.
So,
and the big difference is this one's 41 millimeters and it's a hair over 11 millimeters thick, right? It's like, it's an actual, like, quote unquote, like normal sport watch size.
Yeah, it's exactly like it's the same size as a Seamaster, or it's, you know, a millimeter larger than a Sub. It's thin too. It's like 11.2 something. So, or 11 point, what is it, James? Do you remember?
It's 11.2. Yeah. It's not thin. Yeah, it's not just thin. It's remarkably thin. It's thinner than a Sub.
Yeah, that's crazy.
I think that's a good measure thinner than a BB 58.
58. Yeah. That's incredibly thin, incredibly mm-hmm. wearable. And I think to have the other thing about Sin, which I guess we'll get into, but we should introduce it, is the tegumented steel, which is a undersea submarine steel, which is like really cool because it can expand and contract. So every time a submarine does a dive, it goes down deep, the steel actually contracts and is strong enough to stop contracting. And then when it surfaces again, it expands. And not many metals can take that kind of a lot of cycles doing that. It creates a lot of fatigue. But submarine steel is special. High tensile steel is special in that it can do that. So like giant subs are made from that steel, where like fast attack subs and so forth are made from titanium. So this is like a mm-hmm. special metal that you're getting here. This is like when we were talking about before, the docks that could be rendered in a bunch of different metals. Like, this isn't just metal. This is submarine steel. It's a big deal.
Cool.
It's a great watch.
Can I step in and please correct me, and we can obviously cut this out, but there's Zin has differentiation between sub steel and tegumented sub steel.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, so all of them, all U-series watches use the submarine steel. Some have the tegument, which is a proprietary, literally Zin-developed, baked-on coating.
Right, and even this watch has, like, some renditions of it have only the bezel in tegumented steel, some are the whole watch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you can basically, all of them have tegumented bezels, which means they're very hard to scratch. If you've ever had a watch with a really legit hardening, so a Braymont, a Zin with tegument, or some of the specialized Seiko super bright class coatings can be pretty good too. But Zin's is probably one of the best known because people really abuse these watches. These are watches that are worn by various elements of German military and Leo, and really remarkable thing to finally see the U1 at a size and a price point that really makes it a no-brainer. I mean, this starts just a hair over $2,000.
That's one of the things that makes this watch so interesting to me, right? Is like it's a reasonable size and it comes in at a price point that makes it competitive with actually Doxa in a way. Like, these are two brands that for whatever reason I feel like have a lot of overlap in terms of their fans. But they haven't really had competing products in a lot of ways. And it feels like this kind of maybe puts them head to head. I don't know. Maybe I'm misreading that, but that's kind of how it feels to me.
Yeah, it's a strong price point. I think they're going to be competitive. I mean, any of the great brands at $2,000 to $3,000 have always known that Zen is there with a huge enthusiast following. And I think it's a really successful design. It's also a distinctly modern watch. There's no kind of Fotina. There's no, oh, we made a dive watch that looks like the 60s. This looks like a something you would wear on a submarine or while diving. And I like, you know, when the watch came out, Heaton posted a bunch of photos of him diving with the U1. And in all of the photos, and think about the lens you use when you shoot underwater. It's this ultra wide lens to try and get as much of the diver in frame. You can see the time on all of the watches. I mean, it's just such a bold, legible. You know, I think these, in my mind, the U1 has always kind of been alongside something like the Pelagos, a kind of like, not sterile, but kind of stoic. I'm a dive watch, like no concerns with a past design or like what could we make if we made it now or when they made it, and to see it out in at 41 millimeters, thin enough to be worn every day, bracelet or rubber, and with a starting price point. I think it was 2160, and then you can go up pretty high if you want to do the full black, the U50S, which has a black bezel and a black case that the only available in the fully tegumented layout, runs the price up quite considerably. But man, I think this is just a killer release and something that Zen's going to move a lot of units to people who have been waiting, basically. And when, on their live stream, they were very clear. Like, they literally started the presentation saying, like, people asked for a smaller U. Here it is. We've been listening. It took us some time to make it thin enough to wear. You get a solid Swiss movement and a ton of lume. Pretty unobtrusive date display. Nice use of color. And I love the look of the steel bezel. I think it's incredible.
Yeah, I agree. All right, just to keep this moving, I gotta cut this one off. We're gonna move to the last of the sort of like affordable tool watches from this week, and that's a G-Shock. This is the NASA limited edition, which, sorry for everybody listening, it is long sold out. I know quite a few Hodinkee team members couldn't even get them in time. I think one or two of our colleagues may have sniped them, but this watch is so awesome. Like, thinking of NASA and G-Shock together is just like, doesn't really get any better than that. And the watch is all white with the red worm logo above the time display. Cole, you wrote this one up, but like this is just so fun to me. I am one of the people who was bummed that I did not order one in time.
You've been working too hard, Stevie. You didn't even have time to snipe it, you know.
I should have known, man. I should have paid attention. But yeah, I think my favorite thing about this might be that when you light up the time display, you get the moon kind of in silhouette behind the time, which I could see being a pretty fun bar trick once we're allowed in bars again. But I think that could be a fun one. I don't know. There's not a ton to say. Do either one of you have anything else to say? I just thought this was like, this is the watch this week that maybe put the biggest smile on my face.
Yeah, I think everyone felt that way, and it felt like something that was a long time coming. It makes total sense instead of like some weird reference that not many people get. Everybody loves NASA. So I think it's a home run and something that should have happened a long, long time ago. So it's very cool to see it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like square G-Shock, NASA, like fucking right. Like, you know, it's of course this is going to be cool. You know, it's an easy home run. Cool. The last new watch I wanted to talk about this week is at the complete opposite end of the spectrum, but like it's been literally decades in the making, so I think we have to talk about it, is the new FP Journ. So this year is the 20th anniversary of the Resonance, the Chronomet Resonance, to give it its full name. And instead of doing what most people would do, which is take the existing watch, put some sort of special dial on it, maybe these days like make it in steel, put it on a bracelet, whatever. FP Journ went the total opposite tack and re-engineered the entire watch. He was like, hey, I have this thing. I did it 20 years ago. It was incredible. throw it away. Let's do something new and make it even better. And so the big addition here is this watch now has a Remontoir in it. So the idea behind the Resonance was always to make a watch that was more precise, more accurate, with the two balances kind of helping one another. Now there's a Remontoir. So we've solved another horological problem here. You know, we're basically like one step shy of like resonating tourbillons. But I think they did an incredible job. They went back to the original dial layout, or not the fully original dial layout, but they got rid of the sort of like parking meter style. So it's like the most recent Resonance in that way. So you have 24-hour time on the left, 12-hour time on the right. In theory, you're supposed to, I think, wear it where the two times are the same, so you can see that they're in sync with one another. A lot of people use one of them for travel time. That's how I would wear it. The other big difference for people who know the Resonance is you'll notice it used to be one crown on the right side of the case, one crown in the top of the case between the lugs, which made it exceptionally difficult to wind. The two crowns are now on the right side of the case. Aesthetically, I don't like it as much personally, but I think practically it makes way more sense. Jack, instead of writing an introducing post, wrote an in-depth story here that gets into the whole history of the Resonance, how the development operated for making this new version. It's a pretty serious story. I highly recommend you go read it. I've had to read it two or three times already, parts of it three times, to fully comprehend what's going on. And this is a watch I know pretty well. So go check it out. I don't know. What did you guys think about this, this release? I'll stop babbling about how much I love this watch.
Yeah, we loved it so much. We're speechless is what it sounds like.
I mean, it's such a complicated thing. It really requires an essay or you know, in this case, closer to maybe two essays from Jack to get your kind of head around it. I mean, it's Jorn doing exactly what he does. There's even, like, what I like about this is there's even some irreverence to the past Resonance in the new one. It's like he said, well, we can do better, so we did. And there's a little bit of it that looks back at it, but I think a lot of it is kind of like a very forward-thinking. It's also gorgeous. You know, like, talk about a style that they've been working on for years that I think they may have really cornered in on something that kind of has the best of all of it without being too in your face or too asymmetric, or, I mean, in this case, there's almost no asymmetry at all. It's really a lovely thing. It's just kind of a jaw dropping creation. But I definitely can't add anything technical to what Jack's already put in. So I would just say go read his piece for sure.
Yeah, you and me both there. I'll just add, like, the Resonance is one of those watches that, you know, I have a personal attachment to. It's one of the first watches that really caught my attention. I would put it up there with, like, in a very different way, the IWC Portuguese automatic, the 7-day with the two sub-dials. I'd put it up there with something like the Zeitwerk from Lange. These are those watches that, like, in the early days when I kind of knew maybe watches were a thing I kind of wanted to check out. It was something I was paying attention to on other people, but I really didn't know anything. I hadn't gotten into really, like, diving in yet. But, like, I would see these on people and go, holy shit, like, what is this? How do I understand this? Like, this is a thing I need to know more about. And seeing a Resonance on a friend, you know, probably back in, like, it was probably like 2009, maybe 2010, was one of the things that just absolutely captured my attention. And I've never become less infatuated with this watch. It's a watch I someday hope to own an early Resonance. Although now I may need to own the newest Resonance, but I think it's, like you said, James, I think it's F.P. Jorn doing F.P. Jorn in a, like, totally unabashed way. Just go read Jack's piece. He's much more eloquent about this than I am.
Lots of killer stuff, though.
Before we wrap up today, yeah, it's completely killer. Before we wrap up today, there's two other quick things I want to touch on. Cole, while I have you, you've been doing these stories for us for these last couple weeks, these retailer spotlight stories, and I just quickly wanted to talk about your experience there. you know, the kind of bricks and mortar retail side of watchmaking isn't something we deal with terribly often at Hodinkee in our day to day as writers, because we're dealing directly with brands most of the time. We're sourcing watches, you know, directly from them. We don't really report on the retail dynamics. I mean, Joe does to some extent, but those of us covering product don't really have reason to interact that often. But we forget that, like, for most customers, this is their main way of interacting with watches, especially in the metal. You know, they're not calling up Lange and having a sample sent to their apartment. You know, they go to Wempe and they check it out. You know, they don't go call Rolex and say, hey, can I come up to your showroom and see the new sub? They go to Fortane, you know?
That's right.
So I just wanted to know quickly, like, what has it been like for you these last couple of weeks working so closely with these retailers? I mean, you're talking to folks multiple times a week. You're publishing stories about 4 retailers a week now. How have you found it?
Well, it's a lot of work to start with, but the experience, I guess, what's the takeaway? What do you learn? A few things. I think that even we forget about all the contributions, kind of like what you touched on here, but these guys are doing a ton for the scene. And you learn about that every time you talk to a new retailer. They say, oh, I've got this side project, or, oh, like, you know, we've done a million Hodinkee collabs. Turns out retailers have done a bunch of collabs too with brands. And like this one that was featured yesterday, this one out of the Netherlands, they actually founded watchbase.com, which I know we all use.
That's rad.
All the time. Basically every day.
So yeah, which is kind of crazy. Like, who knew that? And then you kind of get these historical tidbits. Like, there was one of them in the early days, they sent a photo, which was like, would have been right after the Civil War, of their storefront with some Union soldiers or something standing outside. Very, very cool. And the other things too, like, yeah, we don't talk to these folks often. So there's not, I would say that in these times specifically, the whole watch world is super cohesive. So under normal circumstances, would we like get the chance to interact in this capacity? No, but now we are, and we're kind of like everyone's on the same team sort of thing, which is awesome to see, you know?
Yeah, I know. I mean, I've had some pretty great interactions with retailers over the years when I can. I mean, I already mentioned Wempe and Fortane, and those guys are some of the best people in the watch industry that I know. I mean, like, they're so passionate, and they're really on the front lines, you know, communicating to consumers, trying to get people interested. Obviously, they're selling products, but, you know, they really see themselves as kind of like standard bearers in a lot of ways, and it's great. I've been to some really awesome events. A couple years ago, these folks, Razzny in Chicago, opened a half Patek, half Rolex store on Oak Street, which, like, you know, I can't imagine like a more perfect business to be in, by the way, than selling Patek and Rolex on like the most exclusive shopping street in Chicago. But like, we just went out there for the opening. It was like the first new Patek door in years, and they invited some folks from Hodinkee, and we said like, yeah, sure. So Frank and I went out for a 2-day trip to Chicago, and we surprised the Patek team there. They didn't know we were coming. We did this all independently. This wasn't like a partnership or a deal or anything. And it was so fun to see, like, you know, this family business. They had their like 17-year-old son giving a speech about how like he's so proud to know that someday this will be his store. And like, it's a really touching, like, kind of old school business in a lot of ways. Like, we forget that, you know, you have the big box kind of watch retailers, but a lot of these places are mom and pop. You know, the Fortane's another great example. Like, you know, I've met basically the entire Boniface family at this point. You know, Bindi in LA is another great example. And it's cool. I've personally, Cole, found it really like touching to read these stories, and it's a nice reminder that we're doing a lot of this behind our keyboards, and we don't see these people every day, but, you know, these are good folks, and we get to build good relationships, and so do they. And they're a big part of our business.
And
I mean, I know James, one of the retailers Cole covered was your local retailer when you were in Vancouver, right?
Yeah, Roldorf & Co. Really good friends, great people, deep into watchmaking and supporting the education of watchmaking, both around Vancouver and then down into Seattle where there's a school. You know, family owned business. They carry a bunch of really interesting brands. He's WoStep trained. Jason Gallup is the owner operator there, along with a couple other guys as his crew, his watchmaking crew, servicing crew. And, I've had him on the Grenado in the past, so you can go back and dig that up. But I mean, this is a guy that came out of the same class at WoStep as Kari and Stephen Forsey. And he
that's a pretty good company.
He runs a killer shop in Vancouver, and they're just moving into a new space, so they'll be able to kind of launch that once retail exists again. And I was very much thankful, and I know they were too, of Cole and his willingness to give them some spotlight on the retailer highlights.
Yeah, of course. Nice. Something cool I'll share really quick. I had to go down to Philly this past weekend, and I was walking down the street. So keep in mind, some of these retailers I have never been to before, like ever.
Okay.
And the way we were, you know, flooded with requests, and we kind of work through them in time, but there's a bunch in the pipeline, right? So I was walking down the street in Philly, in Manayunk specifically, and I walked past this really cool storefront. I'm like, whoa, this is sweet. There's like model airplanes, model cars, watches. In fact, I think there was, yeah, like Urwerk or something. Was in the window. And I'm like, whoa, this is sweet. I look up at the sign, and it's a guy I've been emailing with back and forth for weeks about this column. And I'm like, oh man, this is sweet. Like, I'm so excited to go here. It was Martin Pooley in Manayunk, Philadelphia. So
Martin's the man.
Yeah, well known.
It was just so crazy. Yeah, yeah, totally well known. But like, I had never been past the storefront in Philadelphia before. And then all of a sudden I'm walking down the street, and then wow, there it is. Everything we're talking about is right here. So one of those coinky dinks, as they say, you know?
Nice. Well, Cole, you know, to finish things off, I just want to ask you one more question, and it's about a story that hasn't been published yet, so I don't want to talk too much about it. But you're working, people who are listening will get a little sneak peek here, but you're working on a story about vintage watch advertisements, another part of this business that is, you know, not entirely related to what we do on a daily basis. And you're looking through old Europa Star issues, a watch industry trade publication that's been around basically forever. And I just wanted to know, what is the thing you are most excited to share with people in this story? I don't want to spoil the whole story, but what thing are you most amped to publish?
Interesting question. Yeah, I would say just the ads from brands that are no longer around that you probably don't know of. Like, not to say you don't know these brands, but more like we just forgot them. Like, a lot of these brands went away from that were, you know, actively advertising in magazines in the 60s and 70s and so forth. And they have some wild advertisements. So I'm excited to put those in front of people. And also offer a little context too. The crazy thing is that advertisements, the role of the watch in our lives and the role of the watch in the industry or whatever, has changed dramatically over time. It used to be necessary. Now it's just kind of a thing that we all talk about, and it's a luxury. But the advertisements really haven't changed that much. So kind of getting into why, and also just getting nostalgic about old watch ads, you know, that's it.
Love it. A little bit of old watch nostalgia never hurts. I've actually found myself wearing my vintage pieces a lot more lately. I've been wearing mostly modern watches for a while, with the exception of that vintage Grand Seiko. But I've been wearing my vintage pieces a lot more these last 2-3 weeks. There's something kind of comforting about it. I don't know.
This will be a piece for you, Stevie.
Perfect. Thanks, guys. We ended up going pretty long here, but I think it was worth it. And appreciate all your perspective, and we'll keep the new coverage rolling. I think we're now in the thick of it. I think we're going to see some new pieces rolling out pretty consistently over the next couple weeks, and we'll keep everybody up to date. Awesome. Thanks, guys.
Cheers.
Up next, we've got Ben's conversation with collector and writer Edmund Sarin.
So we have a very special guest here on Hodinkee Radio today, a man that is probably very well known within the high-end watch collector community, a man named Edmund Sarin. And Edmund has been operating a blog for how many years now, Edmund?
Six.
6 years. And what was the impetus for starting the blog?
I think I started at the time where I was fed up of the financial markets giving me a hard time. And I had started collecting watches and cars, and I was basically a way to document, you know, if I'm doing things right, what models I find interesting, and just kind of a nice way to enter a different world than just financial markets.
Yeah.
Be creative and write and dream about things, and it was a nice balance.
Yeah, and your blog, which has a URL of, what would be the URL for your blog?
The URL?
The website address for your blog.
It's lemondedmond.com.
Mm-hmm. So the world of Edmond.
Yes.
And so this blog has kind of made a name for itself in that you are an unabashed collector. You're not a journalist. You're not somebody that is within the space. You're a true collector. This is a non-commercial blog, unlike myself, unlike Odinke here. It is a blog that is purely your opinion and purely what you find interesting, which I think is a really unique perspective in the watch world today, which is, you know, a lot of guys are trying to turn this into a business. A lot of guys are really trying to glean something from this, gain something from this. You're not at all. You're just doing this for the love of watches and to potentially share your taste and your interest in watches.
Yeah, I think you said it. I couldn't have said it better than you. Absolutely.
Sorry, I have a phone call coming in from Switzerland right now, okay. Which is not surprising at all. Sorry about that. And so give us a little bit of your background. Where are you from? Things like that.
So I come from quite an international background. I have a German mother, a German-American mother. My father was Egyptian-Lebanese. Hmm. I grew up basically in Switzerland most of my life, studied in America.
Did you go to school in Europe or the US? Or?
I went to university in America.
Oh, yeah?
I went to BC.
Oh, sure.
And then I went back to Europe, studied there. Then I came back and did a master's at Johns Hopkins.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to become a diplomat.
Sure.
And
it would fit you, by the way. I could see you as a diplomat.
Okay.
Yeah.
I take that as a big compliment.
And then you went into finance after that.
And well, I was always into finance. But, you know, I basically 12 years ago decided to work for myself after having worked for banks.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was 30 at the time. And when you work for yourself and things don't go as planned, you know, sometimes it's tough to stick in there. So, and I'm quite broad in my interests. So I thought, you know, diplomacy always interested me.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested in diplomacy. So I decided to do a degree in case I wanted to enter that field one day. It was kind of, that's why I decided to do that.
Hmm. And then how did you come into the world of watches?
So basically, I think my father had a big influence on me because, and that's why I also love Rolex so much. When I was about 10 years old, and I'm going to be writing a blog post on this, I remember playing with he had a white gold Day-Date with diamonds.
Oh, wow.
And that watch really left an impact on me. And I would play with it and look at it. It has a beautiful blue dial. And so I've always been interested in watches. You know, growing up in Switzerland too, you know, when you turn 18, my mother gave me a Rolex as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was kind of a natural thing to be around watches. And so I think that's how it basically happened. Then I started reading your blog,
sure,
about old watches and other blogs, and sort of migrated from, you know, newer watches to old.
Yeah. And where is your primary focus now as a collector?
In what brands or?
Yeah, what brands? What excites you today?
I would still say, I think Rolex really excites me still, believe it or not, because the crazy thing with Rolex is the more you think you know about the brand, the more you realize you actually don't know anything.
Right.
And, you know, it's so broad. It's so multifaceted. I think the design is so great. And it's so difficult to collect. You know, I love Patek and other brands, but, you know, to collect Patek well, basically, I think you basically need, on a very high level, if you have enough money, you'll collect well.
Mm-hmm.
With Rolex, it's not about money.
Right.
Okay, you need a certain amount, but I think what I love with Rolex is you have to do your homework. No matter how much money you have, if you don't do your homework, you're going to get screwed.
Yeah.
And it's challenging to collect Rolex well. And I'm still fascinated by it. And I think I have a long way to go before I, you know, have a good collection and know everything I want to know about it. So that's, I'm still fascinated by that.
So how do you go about researching any particular Rolex you're looking at?
That's a good question. So I think, you know, today the big advantage is you have so much information online, unlike, you know, 5-6 years ago where people were just starting to put information online. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, between researching online, looking at the auction houses, going to, you know, collector gatherings, looking at the watches at the auction houses, it's basically hands-on research. And I think today you have a lot of resources available for you to make good decisions on collecting well.
Yeah. And how do you view the auction houses and how they play in kind of the ascent of vintage watches as collectible assets?
Can you repeat that again?
Sure. So how do you view, the auction houses and their role in this growth of the, say, the vintage Rolex world, to keep with the theme here?
Well, I think auction houses do play an important role because, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of the auction houses have been around much longer than, you know, you or I have been collecting. Sure. And so they have a lot of research, a lot of, you know, if you go, for example, on a Rolex model they're selling and you hit on the lot notes, they usually have good data on, you know, when the model was introduced, mm-hmm. Etc. So, and... you know, it's becoming harder for the auction houses to find great watches, but I still think they do, and I still think it's a great learning tool to go to the auctions to hold the watch in your hand. So for me, it's auction houses are still valuable in how I buy and learn about watches.
Yeah, and what about the social set that comes with? First of all, you live in Zurich, so you're Swiss. What comes along with...
Actually, I'm American, but...
Living in Switzerland.
Yeah.
Okay, an American abroad.
Just to make that
That's
clear.
That's right. So you live in Switzerland, and obviously the hub of the watch world. Is that an advantage to you? Is that a disadvantage to you? Are you too close to home in some ways? Or is it something that you find really helpful in that you can take a train to Geneva anytime you want, et cetera, to see the auctions?
It's a very good question. I think in some ways it's an advantage because, you know, I'm very close to a lot. I think Geneva still holds the most important auctions of watches, mm-hmm. even though New York is coming and Hong Kong is growing because of the wealth there. Mm-hmm. So Geneva, I think, is important, and you have collectors coming all over the world still to Geneva. And for me, it's just a 3-hour train ride.
Right.
So I think that's a big advantage. Funny enough, in terms of vintage, which is my main interest, I don't think it's necessarily an advantage being in Switzerland because, in fact, I actually think it's a disadvantage. If you look at, I bet you here in New York, for example, there are way more, you know, collectors and meetings and events organized around vintage watches than Switzerland, because in Switzerland, you still have this understated, you know, low-key mentality where people don't show what they have. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not that open as a culture as, for example, Americans are.
Sure.
So, actually, I think if I'd be living in London or New York, I would. It would be better for me.
As a collector.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have many collector friends that live in Zurich, for example?
I don't. It's slowly growing. I'm part of a chat group that's, you know, growing. But no, most of my, you know, collector friends are not in Switzerland. They're all over the world. But I think Switzerland is coming along slowly.
Yeah. And as somebody that is very close to the collector world, and you really are a real collector, you're not buying and selling often. You know, this is you buy what you like and you tend to keep it. Same is true for cars. Who do you admire as a collector?
Well, without, you know, you know, what's the right word? I certainly admire you a lot.
Ah, well, that's very kind.
You know, you're far younger than me, but you've been You have a great sense of style and you're a very broad collector, which I really appreciate. Mm-hmm. So I've learned a lot from you. You know, taking someone older, I think he's for me really still someone I really look up to is John Goldberger, who you also know.
Of course.
His collecting is very broad too. Whatever watch he puts on, it just looks so good on him.
He has that thing about him where he can wear whatever he wants, and not just watches. I mean, I've seen him wear a full denim on denim on denim outfit and pull it off.
Yeah, no, he's I've learned incredible amounts from him, and he's someone I certainly look up to as well. So these are two people come to mind, but you know, it's many. I've learned a lot through many collectors.
Sure.
Some, you know, that are smaller but focused on lesser known brands. So I've been fortunate to know a few collectors who have helped me along the way.
Sure. And what are the watches that you're wearing today?
So I brought, you know, there was this Rolex meeting in New York.
Sure.
And I figured there'd be a lot of subs and a lot of Rolex sports watches. So I brought something different. I brought a 6098 star dial with a honeycomb dial, which is something fun, time only. I think it's underappreciated still, very rare.
Mm-hmm.
And just something fun and nice to look at.
Yeah.
And on the other wrist, I'm wearing a Bombay style 6090. I think that's a reference number. Yeah. And also with stars. So I'm full of stars today.
And so for those who might not understand what a star dial is, obviously stars on the dial. The most famous star dial would be the 6062, which is the triple calendar moon phase, correct?
Right.
And those are, we'll say, very expensive watches.
Yes. So basically, a lot of people, when they think of star dials, they think of that reference. But Rolex made a few time-only star dials as well. I mean, a good example is the Galaxy, which is, you know, maybe the most famous star dial of all, which I think there are only three or four known. It's a beautiful kind of oversized case. It's an Oyster case. I think the size is 35 or 36 millimeters.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sold a few years ago at Philips. I think it's an Asian collector bought it. And ever since I held that watch in my hand, I was fascinated by, you know, time only, just stars on the dial, no moon phase, no triple calendar, no date to distract, just stars, the seconds, the hour hand, and it's something so pure for me.
Hmm.
So after seeing that watch, I became fascinated by time only star dials.
And that's a pretty esoteric, you know, pretty unusual kind of subset of Rolex collecting.
Yes.
It's not just time only. It's star dial time only.
Totally.
Are there many other collectors in this space? Do you know any other collectors in that space?
Not really. And that's why I kind of like it, because it's, I think it's still unexplored. It's unknown. And when these watches, for example, one of the watches I'm wearing came up for auction, and it really, nobody was paying attention to it. Almost nobody bid on it. And I managed to buy it, you know, for close to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's still, I wrote a post about it as well. It's still one of these hidden things within Rolex that I think sooner or later will
catch on.
Yeah, catch on.
Yeah, and in many ways, if you think about these watches relative to their non-star dial peers, it's really one-to-one when you think of a non-Paul Newman Daytona versus a Paul Newman Daytona. They're no different except for the dial. And yet in the Daytona world, you're paying 2, 3, 4, 5 more X, you know? Do you think that could be possible with star dials down the road?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think many, well, for a start, so the references I'm both wearing are actually not very rare references.
Mm-hmm.
But only with stars on the dial, they're very few. So these watches are very rare. And I think they're underappreciated. And I think with time, you know, collectors will find these more interesting because they're so different. And, you know, in the end, I think, how do you differentiate yourself as a collector? You try to own things that not everybody has, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's why, as much as I love the Paul Newman, I'm not that attracted to it because it's so mainstream. And
right.
I find it more interesting to collect things that are beautiful, but not that well known. So I think star dials have a great future.
So obviously you just came from Rolly Fest, which was a big, seemingly wonderful event put on here by our friend Jeff Hess and the guys at Philips. What was that like as a spectator? Was that overwhelming to see so many great watches in one place? Was it interesting because you got to see and meet all these wonderful collectors, or was it a little staid because so many people brought similar watches?
Well, no. So anytime you see, you know, we had, 100 plus collectors coming. We had probably 300 or 400 watches on the table. You know, many of these watches are very rare. So it was overwhelming. I mean, to see so many great, you know, beautiful GMTs or Daytonas or Subs, it really is impressive. Mm-hmm. You don't get to see that very often. And it was overwhelming because you don't almost know where do you start looking? What details do you start looking at? If you pick up one watch, you know, it's you know, you have so many other watches to look at that.
Yeah.
I think it was almost too rushed to really appreciate each individual watch, but sure. it was a great experience.
Yeah. No, that's really neat. And how do you feel about you as somebody who has your own taste, which is, you know, even though it's Rolex, it's very different kind of Rolex. How do you feel about the future of Rolex sports watches? Do you think that it can retain its cool factor? Do you think it can retain its value long term? Or do you think this is something that it might fall out of favor in the same way that bubble backs in the 80s were everything to Rolex? And now they're, you know, they're not worthless, but they're worth, you know, I would say a 10th or a 20th True. Of what they used to be.
Actually, I think it's a great point you make, you know, because nothing continues forever in the sense that, you know, watches go through trends. But having said that, I think, I really do think that Rolex sports watches are, you know, it's going to last because the design is so strong. You know, I think the bubble backs, they're usually smaller in size. They're sure. more for the connoisseur collector. And Rolex sports watches are so timeless. If you look at a 1960 sub, that's going to look good in 30 years or 40 years today. Mm-hmm. And, you know, will the hype slow down and the prices come down a little bit? Sure, it will. But I see, you know, I see a great future. I think more and more collectors will want to own them. I think that's the big advantage that Rolex has over Patek, for example, is it's just a young, cool-looking watch brand.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no other brand that has that coolness factor.
Agreed. And I think, yeah. you know, we, especially in this market, in the U.S., like, if you go, okay, in New York and L.A., people might know what Patek Philippe is, but also maybe not. And then you go to the other markets, everywhere in between, nobody knows what Patek Philippe is. Everybody knows what Rolex is. Rolex is part of the American kind of like social culture.
Yeah.
It is really a special thing that way. So I agree. I mean, there's just not another brand that has permeated, you know, popular culture in the same way that Rolex has. If you could have one watch for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Gosh. Is so something that I own already or?
Whatever you like.
Well, let me answer it in two ways. So the one watch, if I could only have one watch to hold on to, it would be my father's day date, which sure. My mother decided to give me after, I think it was 41 at the time. So she made me wait 28 years. And every year I would beg her that if I could have it. And she said, no. And, you know, that watch is just, I think it really has so much magic for me and so much memories of my father who sadly, you know, no longer live. So that watch is for sure the most important to me. But if we're talking about a watch that I don't own yet, I think my dream, I mean, I have many dreams, but...
We all do.
Sure. It would probably be that Galaxy Black Star dial.
You think so?
Yeah, totally.
Over the Bao Dai, over anything
yeah.
else, yeah.
Because it's so simple, it's so powerful. And, you know, I admire the collector who owns that today. There are one or two out there, but I'm thinking of one collector especially. He has a great taste and a very good eye, and I think it's such a beautiful watch. It's I think that would be the one watch. Plus, not everybody has that. You know, yeah. The Bao Dai is great, but you know there are many black dial S6062 out there.
Yeah. And for those who might not know, Edmund is referring to at Watch Arts on Instagram, who's a friend, and I'm sure you know he would appreciate the. We'll link up to his profile in the notes here. But an amazing collector,
absolutely really one of the for me one of the most astute collectors out there.
Yep, absolutely. Cars are a big part. Well, I wouldn't say a big part of your passion, but you do love them.
Yes.
Yeah, and mostly Ferrari.
I love all brands. So I love Ferrari for the history. I think the history of Ferrari is, you know, it's unbeatable. You had, you know, the crazy founder Enzo Ferrari who, you know, managed to get the best racing drivers in the world race for him. He managed to get the best engineers to build the best engines. He managed to get the best designers like Pininfarina to design the cars. So he's, you know, the brand is so mythical. It's so beautiful. The old cars are just like pieces of art that I appreciate Ferrari for the history. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I love Porsche like you as well, I think. Mm-hmm. I like British cars. So I'm not loyal to one brand, but Ferrari has something special in my heart. Yeah.
It's funny. You know, I've long had this idea of doing car reviews, vintage car reviews, after owning them for some time. And, you know, when I bought my first vintage car, which was a 356, just a B Super Coupe, there was so much stuff that nobody told me that I never would have known that, like, you know, really you just don't even know what you're getting into. And I think, you know, the ownership process of a vintage car is in many ways really different than the ownership of a vintage watch. A watch is a watch at the end of the day. It pretty much, they all do the same thing. You're never going to spend thousands of dollars on a service, maybe a few thousand if you're in a tough spot. Cars can really take it out of you. They can also catch on fire. Yes. They can also kill you. They can also kill other people. I mean,
yes.
They can also, you know, really damage folks financially. And I think, again, this idea of like real ownership of a car is not a simple thing. It requires work, especially a vintage car. And you have, if you don't mind me saying, one of the most iconic cars in the world, one of the most beautiful, in the 300 SL Gullwing. And this is a car that, I mean, I've dreamed of owning since I was a child. I mean, it's a perfect object. And yet you don't love driving it.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about that this morning at coffee, and I briefly told you why. So for me, it's one of the greatest cars ever made. And if you look at the history of cars, and you look at Mercedes after the Second World War, you know, this was, I mean, think about it. In the beginning of the 1950s, they came out with this car where you don't even have proper doors because they designed the car first for it to be a good car to drive and race. And then after they built the chassis, they figured out, wait a minute, the doors don't even fit. And so that's how the Gullwing doors actually were created. It was, there's really nothing quite like it. And as much as I love it optically and to look at, it's very tricky to drive. You have drum brakes. It gets extremely hot in there.
Right.
And there are no windows.
The windows don't open.
Yeah. Right. You have little side windows where the air comes through. But so it's, unless you're a very good driver, which I admittedly am not, it's a very tricky car to drive fast and well. So as much as I love it, it's optically, it's not my favorite car to drive.
It's really interesting. I mean, they say never meet your heroes, you know. I mean, the Gullwing is such an icon. It is the icon, arguably, of the vintage car world. It's amazing to hear that it's actually maybe not that easy to live with.
No, not at all. It's, in fact, as good as it looks, it gives you a headache to drive. And I think I'm in the minority saying that. If you speak to Simon Kidston, who owns one, and all many other collectors, they all love their Gullwings. It just, I think, you know, every experience is different. And I love my car. I'll probably keep it, but I don't drive it often.
Yeah. And it's funny, you know, the last time we met in New York, which was a few years ago, we kind of had two differing collecting philosophies. Mine is of the mindset that you should try to own as much as you can to experience it all. To say like, hey, you know, this watch is for me, this car is for me. If it is, you keep it forever. It sticks with you. You collect it. And if it's not, you move it along, and now you know. And then, you know, this lust, this obsession over this material object is no longer there. You kind of have a different mindset, which is pick what you love and stick with it.
Yeah, I mean, I have that from my mother. You know, I grew up, my mother's German, and she has this old school thinking of, you know, whatever some whatever she managed to get or someone gave her, she held on to it. And I think she instilled that in us when we were small. You know, when we would get something, you know, we would look after it and keep it. And I'm a bit old-fashioned in that way, that I have a hard, I get attached to my things that I own. Mm-hmm. And it's probably, is it the smartest thing? No. You know, does it make the most sense? Probably not. But I have that from her, that I get, you know, each when you buy something and you start using it, you build a relationship with it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something valuable. And, you know, today people get bored of things very quickly. They sell it, they move on. And I think my mother taught us, you know, hold on to your things that you own. And, you know, with time, it's something special to, and one day if I have a child and I say, listen, I got this Gullwing, you know, when I was in my 30s. And look, I'm 72 now and I still have it.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Instead of, you know, if you're always getting rid of things, you can't build up a history with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Have you ever had an experience where you wanted a watch so badly, maybe like the Gullwing, and then you got it and it was kind of disappointing?
That's a great question. Let me think about that. You know what? I've been very lucky. I can't recall of that ever happening to me in watches. I think I've been lucky that, you know, when you attend these auctions and you try things on, I have generally a good feel if I like something or not. No, I can't think of one instance.
You're lucky.
Yeah, I am lucky.
So I want to thank Edmund for joining us today. It's always a treat to see you, my friend, and come back anytime.
Likewise, and thank you so much for inviting me to Hodinkee Radio.
This week's episode was recorded remotely by our group of editors and was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference for us. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.